The king was condemned as a tyrant, traitor, murderer, and enemy of his country. He was taken one January morning in 1649 to a scaffold erected outside the windows of his own banqueting room at Whitehall. There he was beheaded. He died with piety and a certain noble self-pity, 8 years after the execution of Strafford, and after 6.5 years of a destructive civil war which had been caused almost entirely by his own lawlessness. This was indeed a great and terrifying thing that Parliament had done. The like of it had never been heard of in the world before. Kings had killed each other times enough, parricide, fratricide, assassination. Those are the privileged expedients of princes. But that a section of the people should rise up, try its king solemnly and deliberately for disloyalty, mischief, and treachery, and condemn and kill him, sent horror through every court in Europe. The Rump Parliament had gone beyond the ideas and conscience of its time. It was as if a committee of jungle deer had taken and killed a tiger, a crime against nature. The Tsar of Russia chased the English envoy from his court. France and Holland committed acts of open hostility. England, confused and conscience-stricken at her own sacrilege, stood isolated before the world. But for a time, the personal quality of Oliver Cromwell and the discipline and strength of the army he had created maintained England in the republican course she had taken. The Irish Catholics had made a massacre of the Protestant English in Ireland, and now Cromwell suppressed the Irish insurrection with great vigour. Except for certain friars at the storm of Drogheda, none but men with arms in their hands were killed by his troops, but the atrocities of the massacre were fresh in his mind. No quarter was given in battle, and so his memory still rankles in the minds of the Irish, who have a long memory for their own wrongs. After Ireland came Scotland, where Cromwell shattered a royalist army at the Battle of Dunbar in 1650. Then he turned his attention to Holland, which country had rashly seized upon the divisions among the English as an excuse for the injury of a trade rival. The Dutch were then the rulers of the sea, and the English fleet fought against odds, but after a series of obstinate sea fights the Dutch were driven from the British seas and the English took their place as the ascendant naval power. Dutch and French ships must dip their flags to them. An English fleet went into the Mediterranean, the first English naval force to enter those waters. It put right various grievances of the English shippers with Tuscany and Malta, and bombarded the pirate nest of Algiers, and destroyed the pirate fleet, which in the lax days of Charles had been wont to come right up to the coasts of Cornwall and Devon to intercept ships and carry off slaves to Africa. The strong arm of England also intervened to protect the Protestants in the south of France who were being hunted to death by the Duke of Savoy. France, Sweden, Denmark, all found it wiser to overcome their first distaste for regicide and allied themselves with England. Came a war with Spain, and the great English Admiral Blake destroyed the Spanish plate fleet at Tenerife in an action of almost incredible daring. He engaged land batteries. He was the first man that brought ships to condemned castles on the shore. He died in 1657 and was buried in Westminster Abbey, but after the restoration of the monarchy his bones were dug out by the order of Charles II and removed to St. Margaret's, Westminster. Such was the figure that England cut in the eyes of the world during her brief republican days. On September 3, 1658, Cromwell died in the midst of a great storm that didn't fail to impress the superstitious. Once his strong hand lay still, England fell away from this premature attempt to realize a righteous commonweal of free men. In 1660, Charles II, the son of Charles the Martyr, was welcomed back to England with all those manifestations of personal loyalty dear to the English heart, and the country relaxed from its military and naval efficiency as a sleeper might wake and stretch and yawn after too intense a dream. The Puritans were done with. Merry England was herself again, and in 1667 the Dutch, once more masters of the sea, sailed up the Thames to Gravesend and burnt an English fleet in the Medway. On the night when our ships were burned by the Dutch, says Pepys in his diary, the king did sup with my Lady Castlemaine, and there they were all mad, hunting a poor moth. Charles, from the date of his return, 1660, took control of the foreign affairs of the state, and in 1670 concluded a secret treaty with Louis XIV of France, by which he undertook to subordinate entirely English foreign policy to that of France, for an annual pension of £100,000. Dunkirk, which Cromwell had taken, had already been sold back to France. The king was a great sportsman. He had the true English love for watching horse races, and the racing centre at Newmarket is perhaps his most characteristic monument. While Charles lived, his easy humour enabled him to retain the British crown, but he did so by wariness and compromise, and when in 1685 he was succeeded by his brother James II, who was a devout Catholic, and too dull to recognise the hidden limitation of the monarchy in Britain, the old issue between Parliament and Crown became acute. James set himself to force his country into a religious reunion with Rome. In 1688 he was in flight to France. By this time the great lords and merchants and gentlemen were too circumspect to let this revolt against the king fling them into the hands of a second Pride or a second Cromwell. They had already called in another king, William, Prince of Orange, to replace James. The change was made rapidly. There was no civil war except in Ireland, and no release of the deeper revolutionary forces of the country. Of William's claim to the throne, or rather of his wife Mary's claim, we can't tell here. Its interest is purely technical. Nor how William III and Mary ruled, nor how, after the widower William had reigned alone for a time, the throne passed on to Mary's sister Anne, 1702-1714. Anne seems to have thought favourably of a restoration of the Stuart line, but the lords and the commons, who now dominated English affairs, preferred a less competent king. Some sort of claim could be made out for the Elector of Hanover, who became King of England as George I, 1714-1727. He was entirely German. He could speak no English, and he brought a swarm of German women and German attendants to the English court. A dullness, a tarnish, came over the intellectual life of the land with his coming, but this isolation of the court from English life was his conclusive recommendation to the great landowners and the commercial interests who chiefly brought him over. England entered upon a phase which Lord Beaconsfield has called the Venetian oligarchy stage. The supreme power resided in Parliament, dominated now by the lords, for the art of bribery and a study of the methods of working elections, carried to a high pitch by Sir Robert Walpole, had robbed the House of Commons of its original freedom and vigour. By ingenious devices, the parliamentary vote was restricted to a shrinking number of electors. Old towns with little or no population would return one or two members. Old Sarum had one non-resident voter, no population, and two members, while newer populous centres had no representation at all. And by insisting upon a high property qualification for members, the chance of the commons speaking in common accents of vulgar needs was still more restricted. George I was followed by the very similar George II, 1727-1760, and it was only at his death that England had again a king who had been born in England, and one who could speak English fairly well, his grandson George III. Of this monarch's attempt to recover some of the larger powers of monarchy we shall have something to say in a later section. Such, briefly, is the story of the struggle in England during the 17th and 18th centuries between the three main factors in the problem of the modern state, between the crown, the private property owners, and that vague power, still blind and ignorant, the power of the quite common people. This latter factor appears as yet only at moments when the country is most deeply stirred, then it sinks back into the depths.